He's not going to publicly thank you, he or she. The person is not going to, it's not like, okay, you help me, I'll help you. It's nothing like that. You know this word upakara, helping, like, what's that verse? Bharata bhumite hoile manusha janmajar janmasartakar kara paropakar. Para upakar. Para means for others. So the idea is that one should do upakar, or welfare for others. And then the same word upakar, Krishna says, charity, the mode of goodness, is given to someone who is unupa. Un means not. Unupakarine. Who's not going to give some, do something for you in return. So yes, the more you get to the mode of goodness, or anything, dattavyam or jastavyam, you know, this is it, one should give this, or kartavyam, one should do this, it's the right thing to do, it's the right thing to give, and so on. And then in the mode of ignorance, in the mode of passion, Hare Krishna, the boss. In the mode of passion, again, it's a mixture. We'll say the mode of ignorance, you just like, it's just completely hopeless. In the mode of goodness, first of all, either you don't give anything, you give the wrong thing to the wrong person at the wrong time. And like, for example, a drug dealer gives, you know, here's a little addictive drug for you to get you started. I'm a nice guy. And then in the mode of passion, it's like, in the mode of passion, the person, people in the mode of passion are ambitious, they do want to return, but they kind of like the idea of giving also. So in the mode of passion, there's a bit of that goodness, yeah, it feels good to give something, I want to help, but at the same time, I want something in return. So yeah, so in this case we're talking about, yes, if someone just obeyed their senses, they would probably, first of all, they probably wouldn't live more than 48 hours. Because let's say, for example, you were on a cliff and you just felt a desire to fly. Like, oh, that would feel good. I remember that happened in 1972. I was a new sannyasi. And anyway, I won't tell jokes about what new sannyasis were like in those days, but I remember I went to Toronto for a program. The boys told me there was this big building in the middle of Toronto, because there were so many hippies and people taking drugs back then, that the government thought rather than have them live on the street, because in Toronto in the winter, if you sleep on the street, you can really ruin your whole day. So the government built this big building for them. And then a group of these love children or whatever, flower children, they went up to the top of this, I don't know, 20 or 30 story building under the influence of some drug, and they had this sudden epiphany, realization they were actually birds. And so they decided to fly out the building. So, I mean, if you think about it, you can all think of your own examples. We can think of a million examples, whereas if you just do what your senses want, like for example, what if you want to eat something, but what if you eat that, you're going to have a heart attack, or what if you eat that, you're going to, whatever. So, actually, there's this cafe in Phoenix, Arizona that serves really greasy, unhealthy food, and the name of the cafe is the Heart Attack Cafe. So, that was very clever to put a clock right here in front of the speaker. That was actually really intelligent. So obviously, in terms of science, in terms of philosophy, not to speak of spirituality, and even in terms of surviving, in terms of staying out of jail, in terms of not self-destructing within the next 48 hours, in all of these ways, you cannot simply trust the senses. Prabhupada even gives the example, by our senses, the moon is bigger than the sun. We won't go into that. But anyway, the moon is bigger than the sun, according to our senses, but actually it's not. So, that's what this verse says. Can I read the next verse?
Sure.
Ato, therefore. In other words, because what we just read, because all of that is true, therefore, ato, nityam anityam va neha shochanti tad vidaha nanyata shakyate kartum svabhava shochatam iti. Subhava, shochitamiti. Those who have full knowledge of self-realization, who know very well that the spirit soul is eternal, whereas the body is perishable, are not overwhelmed by lamentation. But persons who lack knowledge of self-realization certainly lament. Therefore, it's difficult to educate a person in general. By the way, are there any questions on all these points that we just made? Yes?
You read about much, that the pain and the suffering and the pleasure is like just like an illusion. But is it illusion because it is only temporary, or is there some other principle involved?
Both. Yeah, it's miserable because we lose it. We must lose it. And also, the object itself ultimately disappoints us. You know, people sometimes, quote-unquote, fall in love and all their endorphins are going wild. And then, you know, a little while later, whether it's a month or a year or two or whatever, they wake up and they realize, oh my God, I married a human being. Which is very scary. And so, the objects themselves are, for example, you know, let's say you do like binge eating, like there's some kind of food you really like, so you just like buy a huge bag of it and just eat it all day, and then you get sick and you can't stand to even look at it anymore. The real problem here is that we take something for what it's really not. It's really not what we think it is, and in other words, we think it's full of pleasure, but actually it's limited. It's like, for example, it's just like a simple example that you may see whatever object. For example, you think, well, I've got plenty of gas in my car. Then suddenly the car stops because you didn't have that gas. So it's just not understanding what something really is. And the reason we misunderstand it is that we want to enjoy it. We want to exploit it. And as soon as I want to exploit something, psychologically, I'm an illusion, literally, because I'm not the enjoyer. I'm just a tiny soul, and these things don't belong to me. So the Bhagavatam explains this with very precise psychology by saying that yatha navasi negaugo reinurva partivo nile evam drashtari drishitvam arupitam abudhihi. That actually all of us are drashta, or drashta, which means seers. And that's sort of the Sanskrit word for saying subject. We are subjects. We are the centers of individual personal consciousness. And we have our own life. But drishya means something which is to be seen. In other words, an object. For example, let's say a person is lusty. So let's say a man sees a woman or a woman sees a man with lust. Then the lusty person sees the other person as an object. As an object. Is an object of one's gratification. But actually, that other person is not ultimately an object, it's a subject. That person is a subject of their own life. That person is a subject of their own life. They have their own feelings, their own purposes, and their own ultimate spiritual duties. And yet I strip the person of their, you could say, their humanity, and their spirituality, even of their humanity. I take away from them what is most valuable about them, that it's a person with personal individual consciousness, with free will, with a purpose in life. I take all that away from them and I reduce that person, I radically reduce that person to a mere object of my vulgar enjoyment. And so when we do that, when we psychologically or mentally or even physically degrade a person like that, of course there are consequences. First of all, it's just unreal. That's not really what the person is. It's like, for example, I've been on this preaching tour and I was just so tired sometimes, so busy, and so many programs that I had two little tubes in the bathroom counter. One was skin cream, the other one was toothpaste. And so actually once or even twice on this trip, I actually began to brush my teeth with skin cream. And fortunately, don't try that at home, you could hurt yourself. So, anyway, I being, you know, very smart, it only took me a little while to figure out that's not toothpaste. Skin cream. But it's something like that. It's like, don't brush your teeth with skin cream. Unless you're very eccentric. So, So the point is, I mean, the whole point of Maya is that you take something to be something that it's not. And everything actually belongs to Krishna. Krishna says, Bhoktaran, that actually he's the enjoyer. So if we don't, if we think we're the enjoyer, it's actually just a category mistake. It's like Prabhupada's famous example, the hand trying to eat food instead of giving it to the stomach. Or not watering the root of a tree. It's just not understanding what things really are and how they really work. And also, when we try to exploit people, for example, if I go, let's say you own a store, and I go into your store and take the merchandise and just walk out and don't pay, then I've injured you. I've exploited you, and therefore the law will punish me. So if you think about it, the basis of justice, the basis of law and order, the basis is not respecting fair exchange, not respecting fair reciprocity. And this point of reciprocity, which Krishna says, yejitha mam prapadyante, and actually, we just published a little book on the Gita. It's actually one of the most important themes of the Gita, reciprocity. For example, Krishna says in chapter 3 that the devas, demigods, are giving us so many things. If you don't reciprocate, then Krishna says, stena eva saha, you're a thief. It's like, again, you go into a store, you take something and don't pay for it. Or a relationship. If you accept someone's love and affection and you don't reciprocate it, then you're exploiting that person. So at all levels, in terms of what is a healthy relationship, what is a proper system of justice, how does the universe work, and ultimately, how do we approach Krishna? It's all the same principle, reciprocity. And that's why Krishna says that yagyartha karmanon yatra loko yam karma bandana, that apart from this process of yagya, which is just a formalized, sacralized reciprocity, that apart from this, this entire world is nothing but bondage. In other words, apart from paying for things that you take in stores, apart from that, everything is just going to prison. And that's actually what Krishna's saying. That's what Krishna's saying. So, reciprocity with God, with nature, with people and relationships, with society, reciprocity is literally what makes the world go round. That's what Krishna says, evam pravartitam chakram, that literally a wheel has been made to turn, or a cycle has been, that's what it literally means, a cycle or a wheel has been made to turn. Evam and nanu bharti atiyajo, if you do not keep this wheel turning, and of course this wheel or cycle Krishna is talking about is anad bhavanti bhutani, that this reciprocation with God and nature, that, you know, it rains and food grows, we eat the food, we get strength, we work in the world, and we have to offer the fruits back to the people that gave us the rain and the food. So Krishna calls this a wheel or a cycle that is made to turn. And if you don't keep this wheel turning, in other words, you don't offer back, then Krishna says, agayur, your ayur, like Ayurveda. Ayur means literally duration of life. So Ayurveda is knowledge of how to, you know, keep life going. So your whole life becomes aga, like agasura, or what they say in Western Sanskrit, agasura. In other words, your whole life just becomes an offense. It just becomes an offense to the universe. Agayur indriya ramo. Could someone tell the good news? Indriya ramo. Indriya rama means literally sense gratification. Sense gratification. Because a person is, their life is an offense to the universe because they're simply living for sense gratification. Mogam partisajivati. That person lives in vain. So Krishna describes that in the entire universe, loko yung, this whole world, there's just two options. You reciprocate or you go to jail. Just as in normal society. And that's the way everything works. It's the way families work. It's the way relationships work. Systems of justice, law and order, society. It's the way the whole universe works. Reciprocity. And that's one of the main themes in Bhagavad Gita. So, back to your question. Yeah, so if someone is just sort of willfully stupid and malicious or exploitative, then It reminds me of this. I have five more minutes, six more minutes. It reminds me of, it's like Beat the Clock. You know, they had this whole show on television when I was a kid, you know, someone had to beat the clock, racing against time. So, Socrates. There's a very interesting Socratic dialogue called the Euthyphro. And Euthyphro is basically a self-righteous idiot who did some bad things, you know, thinking he's very righteous and very moral. So Socrates is talking to him and trying to explain to him what real morality is. And so Socrates asks him this really interesting question. Socrates says, are some actions good because the gods love them? In other words, is it good, to offer your food to Krishna just because Krishna likes it? Just because Krishna likes it? And, or do the gods or God love some actions because they are intrinsically good? And it's the second, which is the correct one. Krishna, in other words, everything Krishna asks us to do, Krishna's not exploiting us. He's not some whimsical God like, you know, the rich get richer. Okay, I'm already God, I own everything, but I want to enslave you also because, you know, just be one more kick I can get out of life. The point is, parents, just like when parents tell their children to do things, loving parents, it's because it's actually good for the child. So everything we do in Krishna consciousness, we do because it's actually good for us. And that's why Rupa Goswami discriminates in chapter 6 of his Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu between actions which are fundamental to Krishna consciousness, basic principles, because they provide us an essential good, and activities which are simply details, different detailed, time-bound, ethnic, cultural strategies to try to serve a higher principle. Just like that famous verse that smartavyaksatatam Vishnu, always remember Vishnu or God. Vismartavyana jatu, never forget Vishnu. And sarve vidhi nishedakshu etayoriva kinkara. All of the do's and don'ts, all of the positive injunctions, like do this, vidhi, and prohibitions, nishedha, don't do that. They're all servants. Etayoriva kinkara. Every rule in the universe, like you must do this, or you should do this, is serving one rule. Remember Krishna. And every prohibition, don't do that, is serving one. Don't forget Krishna. So everything that we do in Krishna consciousness is practical. So when I joined this movement, several years ago, when I was even younger than I am now, if you can imagine that. What do they say? Never ask a woman or a sannyasi their age. So when I joined the movement, I was really enthused by the idea of a spiritual science. I was so inspired, and I still am. And that's why in my own life, I think it's important to say, is this a spiritual science, or is this simply, you know, whatever? Is this really an essential part of bhakti yoga? And we have a list from Rupa Goswami, and Prabhupada also explains these things. So, Mandali?
I don't think the practical question, in view of your traditionalist approach, something that I've been noticing in the temple room for many years, and I just wonder, where did it come from, this etiquette that ladies always do everything second in the temple room, like
well, it's a relief to have a non-controversial question. First of all, when I first joined the movement, there was no woman's side or men's side. In fact, you can see the old Back to Godhead articles, because we were all sort of like brothers and sisters, and then the men and women were divided. It's not a Vedic injunction. In fact, the only real reference we have in the Bhagavatam is sort of the opposite. For example, when the Pandavas were going after the battle of Kurukshetra, I think in chapter 7, I think it's the first verse perhaps of chapter 7, the first canto of the Bhagavatam, when the Pandavas were going down to the Ganges to perform all the funeral ceremonies, they put the women in front. So, I can't interfere, you know, in temples. But my own view is that I actually asked, I was thinking that when I asked the when the men started chanting the verses, and I was actually out of respect for Yadananda Swami because he's sannyasi. So I observed that. I thought, but yeah, I think it's very important for men to be gentlemen. It's like, for example, you see that when families bring their children to the temple, their main concern is to bring their children before the deities. And so I think that, yeah, that's my own view, that then we should be gentlemen. So, now having got myself in trouble, I guess, are there any other questions? Yes.
Explain more about the value. You said about how the value is like a metaphysical aspect. How can you expand on that? You know how you're saying that when you perceive the benefit in some object, it's not like empirical.
No, I'm talking about values. Yeah, for example, let's say justice. Why? There's another point of view that actually there's another philosophy. Nietzsche talks about the Ubermensch, the Superman. And Callicles in a discussion with Socrates, the idea is that if I'm stronger than you and I can enslave you, why not? Why should I think about you? Because empirically we're not equal. The whole basis really of morality in the Gita and also in the European Constitution, the whole basis of morality or justice is that we're equal. Because if we're not equal, why democracy? And so empirically we're not equal. Empirically, equality is absurd, and therefore empirically, democracy is absurd. It's very interesting how modern Western people, or just modern people, try to be so scientific, but the entire political system, the entire justice system, is based on an assumption, a religious assumption, which is empirically absurd. But they don't notice that because this is not the age of intelligence. But actually, democracy is based on a totally unprovable, empirically absurd, metaphysical assumption. That despite all empirical evidence, somehow we're equal. Since our bodies are not equal, since our minds and intelligence are not equal, the only possibility is that we're spiritually equal. And actually, Thomas Jefferson, who was no dummy, it's funny, once President Kennedy invited all these Nobel Prize winners to the White House for dinner. And he said, this is the greatest gathering of intelligence at a White House dinner since Thomas Jefferson dined alone. And so, can I have like three more minutes? So here's the point. Jefferson was aware of the Scottish philosopher David Hume. The German philosopher Kant said that Hume, we were all sleeping until Hume woke us up. It's a very famous quote. Because Hume said that you cannot derive a metaphysical fact from a physical fact. In other words, let's say a man kills an innocent person. And you say that's evil, that's criminal. But where do you find the evil in the act? You can describe the act physiologically, in terms of forensic investigation, exactly what kind of weapon was used, the weapon was at this distance from the victim, et cetera, et cetera. You can investigate it psychologically, the motive. You can investigate that act in psychologically, sociologically, forensically, physiologically, historically, in every way, but you will not find the evil. You will not find the evil of it. Because the evil is metaphysical. It's based on a higher law that comes from God. So Jefferson, knowing that you cannot derive a metaphysical fact from a physical fact, he said in the Declaration of Independence, we hold these truths to be self-evident. Self-evident is a technical epistemological term also used by Lord Chaitanya. Self-evident, the idea of being self-evident is something you have to claim in order to avoid an infinite regress of proofs. Like water boils at 100 degrees Celsius. So therefore, you put a pot of water on the stove, you boil it at 100 degrees Celsius, right? 100 degrees Celsius? 100. Yeah, at 100 degrees Celsius it boils. So someone could say, prove that's real water. Or prove that's real mercury in the thermometer. So you bring chemicals in to test the water and the mercury. Prove those are real water testing chemicals. And so, in other words, you're pushed back into an infinite regress of proofs, and you can never prove anything. So Aristotle, the father of modern logic, said, the way you escape an infinite regress of proofs is that you must claim that something is self-evident. If it proves itself, there's no extrinsic proof, and therefore there's no regress. So, actually, this is the term Lord Chaitanya used in his discussion with Sarvabhauma or Prakashananda, saying that the Vedas are self-evident. In other words, when you read the Bhagavad Gita, it becomes self-evident that it's the truth, that Krishna is God. And therefore, it doesn't have to be proved by something else. So, with that in mind, I mean, not the Bhagavad Gita, but understanding these principles, Jefferson said, we hold these truths to be self-evident. In other words, there's no further proof required that all men are created equal. Endowed by a creator. So Jefferson locates the equality. He claims that our equality comes from the will of a creator. Because an ultimate creator, capital C, an ultimate creator is a metaphysical fact, which justifies other metaphysical facts, for example, that we're equal. But now in the modern world, which, you know, secular democracy, which is actually sort of a joke, because it's self-contradictory. The two words secular and democracy actually cancel each other out. Because the society is truly, I mean, secular in the sense of, you know, it's not based on any spiritual idea. The words secular and democracy are actually contradictory, but no one notices it. So, if you really accept equality and therefore democracy and a certain concept of justice, that means you believe that ultimately our real identity is not empirical, it's metaphysical. And if you accept that our real identity is metaphysical, the question is, where does that come from? That means that there's actually another, even higher, that's what meta means, that's why Aristotle used that word, beyond the physical. There's a whole metaphysical dimension of reality which needs its own science. If we have a science, and actually Descartes in Europe really tried to get at this. In the 1600s, there was Descartes and Sir Francis Bacon. Sir Francis Bacon in England sort of developed what we now call the scientific method, empiricism, the controlled experiment. And so he was trying to find certitude, he was trying to find objective reality out in the physical world. But Descartes said, you have to first find objective reality in the inner world by examining your own consciousness. Cogito ergo sum. And so, anyway, the materialists won for various historical reasons. But Krishna consciousness, we are providing that spiritual science. We are providing that spiritual science which explains the higher dimension that actually every civilized human being lives in. The dimension of equality, of justice, of compassion. For example, let's say you had no other goal than environmentalism. All you care about is having, you know, a good environment. It would be very intelligent and very advisable to kill probably about maybe 5 billion human beings. Maybe 4 billion if you wanted to be, you know, didn't want to waste the bullets. So, but if you killed, let's say, if you killed 4 or 5 billion human beings, it would be the best thing in the world for the environment. Maybe 6 billion. You know, restore a state of Eden, you know, the Garden of Eden. If you killed maybe 6 billion, then the world would become like the Garden of Eden. But, you know, our sense of compassion, our sense of justice says you can't do that. But again, it's non-empirical. Everyone knows that Hitler was a big fan of Darwin. So if you think Darwinism explains everything, then you would have to be logically consistent, you would have to favor killing at least several billion human beings. Because that, and just keep the best specimens. You know, keep the strongest, keep the most beautiful, keep the most intelligent. Create an ubermensch, you know, race of ubermensch. Why not? But the why not is because of our metaphysical values, which are empirical nonsense. Literally, they have no sense. So therefore, what makes life, what civilizes human life, what makes human life worth living is not the physical. First of all, it's the metaphysical, and yet there is no metaphysical science. There's a physical science, not a metaphysical science, so Krishna consciousness actually provides that so that we can actually have a rational world. That was the original tension in Europe in the 18th century, the whole Enlightenment project. The whole idea was to rationalize human life. But you cannot rationalize human life unless you have a spiritual science. You know, just do the math. So, thank you very much. Hare Krishna.
At 11 o'clock, Maharaj is going to give a presentation on kirtan.
Musicology.
And it's going to happen in ex-college classroom, so you're all invited. 11 o'clock.
And I have a question.